We have gathered together a special panel tonight, both in studio and some will be joining us on the phones, to discuss Hurricane Katrina and the damage that it, or shall we say she, has wrought. My guests in studio are Charles Dowding, who is professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University, and Albert Hunter, who is professor of sociology at Northwestern University as well. Actually, with us on the phone, already I think lined up, is Patrick Michaels, who is research professor of environmental sciences at the University of Virginia. Good evening.
Hey, how are you?
Thank you very much for joining us, Professor Michaels.
Good to be with you.
Let me put this question to all three of you to begin with. Was this inevitable? Is it an act of nature which could not have been, though anticipated, could not have been controlled, could not have been essentially guarded against? Albert Hunter.
It could have been predicted in a probabilistic sense, and one could have made some steps. But I don't think one could have done anything immediately to try and control it.
Same question to Charles Dowding.
Well, the question relates to the storm that would be the design storm and the ability to and the will to pay the money that would be necessary to protect against that particular design storm. And so the question will arise as to whether or not the design storm was chosen properly.
But you're suggesting there would have been a way to protect against it.
Well, but with protecting against increasingly higher categories of hurricanes would require increasingly larger amounts of money, and the question is, would that be an affordable cost?
And to Patrick Michaels, talking to us, I believe, from Washington tonight. What do you think?
Well, this is the accident that hurricane people have been talking about for years. By the way, there is another way that it could have been protected against, and that may provoke, I think, an interesting societal discussion. In 1969, Hurricane Debbie was seeded with silver iodide in the eye wall, and the eye wall began what we call an eye wall replacement cycle, and the wind dropped. Maybe we ought to start thinking about that again.
That's interesting. You think that might be an effective countermeasure?
Well, it certainly was very tantalizing, but that was at the beginning of the environmental movement in 1970, and it was viewed as anathema to tinker with Mother Nature. Of course, it's not anathema to build a city 8 feet below sea level, I guess.
Well, that's a basic question. We were discussing that, in fact, Patrick Michaels, before we came on the air. I was discussing it with Charles Dowding and Albert Hunter. You were suggesting, Charles, that they sort of made their choice a long time ago by building that city.
Yes, the city, of course, is built on the delta materials, which are subsiding, as all deltas are around the world. We know Venice is subsiding, and so is New Orleans.
And so New Orleans is sinking, just as Venice is doing.
Yes, yes, because
that doesn't improve its situation at all.
No, it doesn't. But it through the march of time and through the inevitable consolidation of those materials, the city will continue to decline in elevation.
Yeah. A basic question to the climatologist in our panel, and that being Patrick Michaels. I quote something all three of you will recognize. It is from My Fair Lady. Ultimately, the words are probably George Bernard Shaw's, when Henry Higgins trains Eliza Doolittle, whose speech is improving, by having her recite, "In Hartford, Hereford, and Hampshire, hurricanes hardly happen." That's true. They don't happen in the mid-country of England. Why, then, do they happen as frequently as they do, Patrick Michaels, on the Gulf Coast?
Actually, the real question is, why are there so few hurricanes? Hurricanes occur where seawater reaches a certain critical temperature, and upper surface disturbances are able to gather condensing air together. You would think then, whenever the sea temperature would reach that critical mass, that there would be lots of hurricanes, but there aren't. And it is a mystery why there are so few rather than why there are so many. By the way, we might as well bring in global warming here. As the planet warmed over the course of the last 3.5 decades, there has been no significant trend upwards or downwards in global tropical cyclones. Let's put that one away right now.
Oh, but my goodness, we had an op-ed just today or yesterday on Arianna Huffington's site.
Wonderful.
By Robert, Robert Kennedy, or is he Robert Kennedy Jr., who tells us that it's really President Bush's fault because by not signing the Kyoto Protocol, we have advanced global warming, and global warming stirred up this hurricane.
He could use a course in physics, okay? I'll just leave it at that.
Well, but to respond to it a bit more, what do we know about the connection between global warming, if it's occurring at all, and hurricanes?
I just answered that. As the planet warmed, there has been no significant trend in global hurricanes. Is that enough?
So his assertion is totally incorrect.
His assertion about the Kyoto Protocol doing anything about it is just abysmally, abominably wrong.
Why?
Because the Kyoto Protocol, if every nation of the world did it, would reduce the amount of planetary warming that is occurring by 0.07 of a degree Celsius per half century. That's 0.07 of a degree Celsius. Now, if he wanted it to go into effect 5 years ago, when Bush went in office, that's 0.1 of a half century. That's 0.007 of a degree Celsius. That's the amount of temperature change you experience every second. And if you think that's going to stop a hurricane, like I said, he needs a course in physics.
I think you made your point quite well.
Let me break in here just a moment. I agree with you completely about the Kyoto Protocol and agreement. However, we are in a geologically described period of global warming, which is occurring, you know, probably occurring regardless of the CO2 content of the atmosphere, which of course is raising the ocean levels, which is making the situation worse for cities built on coastal deltas around the world.
Am I talking to the guy from Northwestern here?
Yes.
Is that you?
Yes.
Yeah.
How come they haven't kicked you out of school for saying that?
I don't know why.
It's very politically incorrect.
Well, it may be it's geologically correct.
Yeah,
which is perhaps scientifically
correct,
which is possibly more important. Yeah. In fact, let me put a further question to the guy from the engineering faculty at Northwestern University, to Charles Dowding. Would you explain just how the breaking of the levees occurred? We understand that this was a terrible hurricane. It would have done a great deal of damage. It did do damage all along the Gulf Coast, we know. But the crucial problem in New Orleans is due to the breaking of the levees, which has flooded the city and possibly destroyed it for years and years to come. But why did the levees give way?
Well, let's describe what a levee is first. It's basically an earthen berm which sits on top of these soft delta soils, which are soft and deformable themselves. The earthen berm is constructed of basically local materials, which aren't particularly strong either because they're local to that particular area. And on top of this berm sits usually a small concrete wall then for the last 2 or 3 feet of surge mm-hmm. protection. So given that idea of what a levee is that surrounds the lower parts of New Orleans, then think about the storm surge which occurs. It raises the water level on one side of this berm and not the other side. So the berm now becomes a dam, which is designed to be a dam. The difficulty comes in for prolonged periods of storm surge coupled with high rainfall intensity, then the berm/dam becomes saturated. And as it becomes saturated, it begins to weaken and begins to deform, which the concrete structure on top of it isn't quite as deformable as the earthen berm below it. And then local failures can occur in that top concrete portion. And that then can lead to leakage through that and erosion. So it's a combination of deformation due to the declining strength of the berm with overtopping and subsequent scour and erosion of the earthen berm that forms a foundation for that concrete top portion.
So would it be inevitable if the water level rose beyond the level of the levee? Or do you need a great push?
Well, but both things occur. The water level rises, yeah. And due to the difference in elevation of water inside the levee and outside the levee, that lateral pressure coupled with the seepage pressures of the water then weaken the berm, which leads to its failure.
Where did the idea ever come from to design New Orleans the way they did?
Well, I wanted to interject a point on that earlier. The assumption, or what's sounds like it's being presented is that New Orleans was built as it is immediately and constructed.
But
this
in fact,
is
like,
a long historical process.
Like Topsy, and, it just grew.
Yeah, it began as a very small little settlement.
Yeah.
And to assume that where they settled there, they settled because that's where the river came out. And we have this, major cities along seacoasts are always found where rivers are flowing into the ocean. So it was not built as a city of a million people. It was built as a small settlement and then grew. And so to try and retrospectively sort of say, why did they put a city here? They didn't. They put a village where that happened. And
but has it been the most endangered of all American cities, would you say?
Well, people in San Francisco in the early 1900s
wouldn't have said so.
Yeah.
No. Right. The same question to Patrick Michaels.
What
has it really been the most endangered of all American cities?
In terms of hurricane risk, if we you're right. If we planned things, if we actually planned 100 years into the future, we probably wouldn't have put a big city there. But we did. We call it the city that care forgot. I mean, the way it's sitting there, you'd think it's a city that thinking forgot. There's very little that could really be done except to very expensive engineering. I'd like to ask Professor Dowding, is that your name?
Yes.
What do you think they're going to do? In the Galveston hurricane, which was the biggest single natural disaster in the history of the United States, I'm not so sure that this one still does have the potential to exceed it. I don't know in terms of the number of measures. But Galveston was rebuilt, and essentially the city was jacked up 10 feet. Do you envision something like that happening here?
Well, the surface area of New Orleans and the surrounding parishes is extensive. I don't know the surface area of Galveston during that time period, but my guess is it would be a lot smaller than the present city of New Orleans. The amount of fill that would be required to be brought in would be just unimaginable. To do that,
be so, like the Big Dig, only bigger in Boston,
by on steroids. Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Well, there is another alternative that I proposed with my family, or my family proposed over dinner this evening, which was to think outside the box and rebuild New Orleans as Venice. But then, as was pointed out here, Venice doesn't have hurricanes.
Yes, that's right.
A minor detail.
Actually, one of our listeners had the same notion in advance of the program tonight. The word of what we were doing went out in the usual form. And I had this email before we started, which I now read to you. This is from a listener in San Antonio who says, who asks, why on earth are they even considering rebuilding New Orleans? It has been a disaster waiting to happen for years, and now it has happened. At least they should follow the Galveston lead and raise the level of the city before rebuilding. Is it conceivable in engineering terms? Or is it just out of the question?
To rebuild New Orleans?
At a higher level.
Oh, I just think the amount of soil that would have to be brought in would be so large
to
render that impossible.
You're not thinking like somebody from Washington D.C. Look at the amount of tax dollars that could be redirected in this direction. Please, guys.
Yeah, well, that's a...
Is that positively redirected or negatively redirected?
I have no comment. No.
Gentlemen, we are due for some commercials, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes. Patrick, I gather you can stay with us at least until the half hour.
I can stay till the half hour. Then
wonderful.
I have to go to another show.
And we will return directly after these words. And in our discussion in the wake of Katrina and its devastation, we are joined tonight and we return to Charles Dowding, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University. Also from Northwestern, Albert Hunter, professor of sociology. And on the phone from Washington, Patrick J. Michaels, who is senior fellow in environmental studies at the Cato Institute and professor of environmental sciences at the University of Virginia. Patrick, in the little time we have left, what then do we learn from this? What then does it point to in terms of policy and the need to design a more effective or more intelligent policy?
Well, I think one of the things we've learned is that scenarios that were really not considered happened. Everybody thought that New Orleans was pretty much out of the woods on Monday afternoon, and then all heck broke loose. And number two, we've got to get our where we have big cities. We've got Miami, we've got Charleston, we've got hurricane-prone cities up and down the East Coast. We have to learn more about evacuation and keeping a civil society intact after all hell breaks loose. I think that's one of the real lessons right here.
And that's particularly why I asked Al Hunter to join us tonight. He is a sociologist very interested in neighborhoods in cities and the organization of civic culture within civic centers. We are seeing a real breakdown, are we not?
Yes, we are. I think that's a very pertinent question, not so much what do we do about the hurricanes, but what do we do about the social organization and the people and the consequences for the people. I think in terms of the evacuation, one of the significant things to note here, at least from the surface of what we've seen on television and heard on radio, is that quite an inequality exists in terms of the capacity for that. And anecdotally, the idea that some people simply did not have the resources or the means to be able to leave New Orleans while others did. And so we see an inequality in terms of the consequences.
When you look at the television coverage, as I was doing some today, most of the people marooned in New Orleans are apparently black.
Yeah, I mean, that's the imagery I got as well. So that one can talk about, I guess, the outer parishes, et cetera, the suburbanites, et cetera, I'm assuming it may not have been as affected as much, but as well, many of them have probably gone. But I heard one story about someone paying $3,500. Is that true? I don't know. $3,500 for a cab ride out of...
I heard they lived in the Chicago metropolitan area.
Exactly.
Driving home.
Yeah,
I heard the same story.
Yeah.
But look, it is a common tradition or a common place of social thought that hard times draw people together.
Yes.
We see something like a Hobbesian war of all against all emerging right now in New Orleans. Why?
Well, there is that notion that, you know, a heavy snowstorm in Chicago, 22 inches back in 68, will make people...
67.
Thank you. You were here as well?
Yes. No, I wasn't. I'm a climatologist.
Okay, right. Drew people together. But there have been studies that show that, in fact, if it is of sufficient scale, it will disrupt the institutions, disrupt the social networks, and you will get a disappearance of community. One of the significant studies was Kai Erickson's study of a community in West Virginia, a whole river valley, actually, where a dam broke and wiped out the river valley and, in a sense, destroyed the entire community, set of communities and villages that lived along there. People did not recover. They did not come back. They did not rebuild. Social networks were destroyed. Institutions were destroyed. So it can have these, of this scale, it can have these
And did they turn to anarchy and start assaulting one another?
Well, I think that's more a question of resources at this point.
Yeah.
I think you are in a Hobbesian situation when people are talking about not having water, not having food. We're at Maslow's basic bottom hierarchy of needs. Mm-hmm. And when you take away that sustenance level, people will begin to fight for survival of a variety of sorts. And that is indeed the short term. We are seeing some of that.
Patrick Michaels, will be as good as our word and let you off in just a minute, but give us during that minute your last relevant thoughts on all of this.
Well, I'd like to say that this was completely unexpected, but that's not the case in the atmospheric science community. This has been a scenario that we've been worried about for a long time, and it's going to happen again in another major metropolitan area at some time, and we have to learn as much as we can about this. And by the way, before I go, I picked up in your voice the lilt of Norman Rosenberg, a famous climatologist and one of the very few gentlemen left in the profession.
He is, of course, my brother.
Yes, he is.
Pat, before you run off, I had a question regarding the fact that this will happen again. How do you see federal policy concerning construction along coastal areas changing in the future?
I think that I don't see much change, except probably with regard to containment structures, and maybe we want to think of that worst case hurricane as a real possibility. It seems to me that New Orleans was not engineered for Category 4 or Category 5. What I've seen in the simulations are that these berm failures would occur with a Category 2 hurricane, and in fact LSU had a model that had it fail at precisely the point that it failed in a Category 2.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Patrick.
Well, I know you've been very busy. This is a great show, by the way. Most talk radio is Yell Radio. This is great.
Well, this is the professorial program on commercial radio.
It's terrific.
Thanks so much.
I hope to see you again.
Yes, I do. Hope
nice talking to you.
Myself.
Yes, thank you.
And we will pause for the usual reasons, a quick round of commercials, and then directly back to Charles Dowding and Albert Hunter here in studio. Other guests to join us on the phone as we proceed, and we will proceed right after this. And we return to two fine guests from Northwestern University. Albert Hunter is professor of sociology there. Charles Dowding is professor of civil and environmental engineering. Albert, let's get back to what we were talking about before we went to the commercials, namely the social disorganization that follows upon this disaster. And it is a disorganization due to perhaps a million people having been deprived of their homes, homes to which they probably can't return because the homes are either destroyed or almost unrestorable.
Right. And it's not just the homes. Obviously, it's the idea of having a home and a shelter and a roof over your head is very significant.
It's the institutions around.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the total, what we could think of here is the web of life that these people will have. And the institutions, the stores, the churches, the synagogues,
the hospitals.
The hospitals, and even down to the social networks. That is, people have social networks that they rely on, and as people have been dispersed now, have moved out of New Orleans, etc., these social networks are gone, the institutions are gone. These are very difficult to rebuild.
All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. Can you put New Orleans together again?
I'm not sure one would want to, obviously, given the consequences that we've faced here. The question is, if we do put it together again, what would it look like? How might it be different? And I think that's one thing that we might think about. We should not necessarily just think about putting New Orleans back together so it looks like it is on the map or was on the map earlier.
Charles Dowding, is there reason in terms of the engineering issues as well as the sociological issues, is there reason to contemplate the alternative of not putting New Orleans back together again?
Well, I think the costs of reconstructing New Orleans are going to be so monumental that it will give us pause to think about whether or not there is an alternative or a way, as we might say, to think outside the bathtub. That do we want to rebuild this bathtub?
Do we have any American city that we've ever let slide into decay and allowed to disappear?
Well, not intentionally. There's probably been issues of benign neglect.
Yeah.
Well, some little
areas,
mining towns in the West disappeared because the mining dried up.
Right.
But a major American city.
I don't think we've ever seen that happen. Right. I think the web of the economy is such that it would regenerate itself into some great degree. But there's going to be enormous costs associated with rebuilding.
What sort of costs do you have in mind?
Well, just think of you talk about the social infrastructure, think of the physical infrastructure. We've got above ground utilities, the telephone and power lines had to be completely restored. You have the below the ground utilities, the sewage and water provisions. Those of who knows what the disruption is there, to say nothing of the reconstruction of all the homes that possibly all of the wood frame homes may be a total loss. It would have to be completely rebuilt, which would be just a significant percentage of the entire infrastructure.
Another distinctive aspect of the infrastructure, so-called, or so to speak, of New Orleans is the cemeteries, all of which are above ground.
Right. I would like to suggest, again, thinking outside the bathtub here, that we think we are at an age of new technology, and how with the internet, with all of this, and with new transportation systems, etc., that we think other than simply a central city and outlying neighborhoods, etc., but we can think polycentric cities. We can.
What is a polycentric city?
Well, where you have not simply one major downtown, which defines the city. But you have a variety of different satellite cities, as some have called them.
Ring cities, which we've got around.
And
cities,
we could go back. We could go back to Ebenezer Howard's, 19th century idea of diverse cities on periphery, et cetera, that are interconnected in a variety of ways. This is why I'm saying that we might have a different model of a city in mind.
But meanwhile, what do you do with the people?
Yeah.
I've got varying estimates as to what the total population of New Orleans is. I've seen estimates. Some people have said it's 500,000. Others have said as much as 1.5 million.
Yeah.
I suppose that includes a good part of the metro area beyond the city limits.
Right.
But even so, suppose it's 1 million people who've been displaced. If they don't go home again, some of them are surely unemployed, but most of them fitted into some aspect of the economy.
Right.
How do you fit them back into organized American life?
Well, again, some of them will fit back in, but you have to build the infrastructure, both physical and social, for them to have something to fit back into. In other words, they need an armature around which they can build.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, though, is I think many of them will stick where they are, and as they're being dispersed, that some of them will, in a sense, decide not to return.
20 or 25,000 are supposedly going to wind up, at least temporarily. There will be a long temporary stay, apparently, in the Houston Astrodome.
Right. Corbusier would love that. I mean,
why Corbusier?
Well, he designed these megacities,
sure,
or the notion of the megacity, and so the Astrodome would be an example of that.
Which
obviously, a disaster.
You think they might ultimately blend into the economic life?
That's what I'm saying. They could very easily, by institutions in the communities that they are going into, they might begin to become incorporated into the existing institutions, into those communities, and simply decide, I'm staying here.
Charles Dowding, I gather that if you had your druthers, as they say, or if you were running this whole operation, you might very well argue, let's let old New Orleans go and do something else.
Well, there are a number of long-term issues, one of which we haven't discussed this evening, and that is the Army Corps of Engineers has basically allowed New Orleans to be on the Mississippi River. The Mississippi River right now would rather flow down the Atchafalaya, whose path to the ocean would be one half the distance.
How do you know what the Mississippi would rather do?
Well, because it tried to do this once before, back when the dam was almost lost there that the Army Corps of Engineers
had built. Now, explain that. It would rather go where?
It would rather take a shorter path to the ocean.
Uh-huh.
Right now, it takes a very circuitous path.
It meanders, doesn't it?
It meanders and takes a circuitous path out through this, what we call a bird's foot delta. It turns out that if it were to take a right-hand turn somewhere where the boot begins in Louisiana, if we take a right-hand turn there, the path to the ocean would be only half the distance of its present path.
Well, why was it not allowed to do so?
Well, because we wanted to maintain New Orleans as a major seaport. And, the Corps of Engineers was instructed to
had bypassed it, would have lost its status as a seaport.
The Mississippi would flow in a different path, and there wouldn't be a major river flowing past New Orleans. So from a geologic perspective, this will happen eventually.
Yeah.
And we have instances in the Euphrates Valley where geology has completely transformed the region.
A television ad years ago, I forget what they were advertising, but Mother Nature was represented as a presence.
Yes.
And her punchline was, you don't fool around with Mother Nature.
There are geological forces that are far greater than human forces.
Right. But the Corps of Engineers did fool around with Mother Nature.
They've been able to tinker around enough that they've been able to keep Mother Nature somewhat contained.
I think the Army Corps of Engineers and Mother Nature operate on different time scales.
Yes, they do. Mother Nature is going to be far more patient than the Army Corps of Engineers.
But in the nature of civilized effort in the latter day, since the scientific revolution, terraforming of Terra itself has been common. We build dams, we reorganize things, we build great subway systems. All of that is fooling with Mother Nature.
Yes, and Mother Nature strikes back. It covers Pompeii with volcanic ash. Mm-hmm. The Nile Delta is sinking. There's old Alexandria now is below water. We have mythic tales in our heritage of Atlantis sinking. We know Venice is sinking.
Mm-hmm. And we build San Francisco and L.A. on major faults.
We've got other problems that we haven't even yet discussed. And we're now going to go to another guest who is with us on the phone. Let me introduce him. This is Dr. Ronald Hershaw, who is professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at the University of Illinois Chicago School of Public Health. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. Hi, how are you?
Fine. Thank you very much for joining us. The one thing we have not yet discussed, probably much we haven't discussed, but surely a major dimension of the current crisis is the health, or rather the disease consequences of what has happened in New Orleans. Can you fill us in on that?
Well, we're rewriting the book. I mean, I don't think America has quite had a disaster that is this large in magnitude. But what we've learned from other hurricanes, and certainly until this, we consider 2004 one of our most horrendous hurricane years, is that in general, we've been used to a situation where epidemic disease does not usually emerge after hurricanes, but that where the potential is there for the exacerbation of many health problems. One of the major issues, I think, facing citizens along the Gulf Coast now is the fact that they've lost the surety of clean water. They've often lost electricity and refrigeration, so food safety is in doubt. They've often lost access to health care and to their medications and to electrical equipment that is essential to their survival, things like delivery of oxygen to people who need that. And on top of that, they've often lost their domiciles and the psychological support of their usual social networks.
And those who are still in the city are stomping around in befouled water, aren't they?
Absolutely. So,
what would they encounter in the water itself?
Well, there's the potential for a wide array of enteric infectious pathogens to be present in the water. Everything from salmonella to hepatitis A might emerge in these kinds of situations. In addition, cuts and scrapes and bruises are common in this situation, and the water, the befouled water, can contaminate those wounds and lead to wound infections and abscesses and so forth. Mm-hmm. Even theoretically, tetanus could result from a contaminated wound in that situation. Mm-hmm. So if tetanus inoculations are not up to date, some people could be at risk of that kind of problem.
Here's a further question from Charles Doughty.
Dr. Hershauser, I've heard it said that in the past that the disease vectors have been relatively small after flooding events, but since this isn't really a flood, is it? I mean, this is like a shipwreck. These waters won't quickly recede. They're there. They're rising. If the Army Corps of Engineers can't get the pumps back on, they'll be there for some time. And wouldn't there be a greater possibility of these pathogens creating medical danger?
I think that's an excellent point, and that's why I introduced everything by saying that what we're dealing with here may be something that rewrites the book on these things. As far as prior experience, we may have to throw that out the window to a certain extent and react to this challenge in new and creative ways to ensure the maximum safety for these people. I think you're right. This is water that is not going to recede quickly. That raises the potential for all of the diseases I mentioned previously, but it also means that mosquito populations will be on the rise. We now have in this country an endemic problem with West Nile virus, which will likely thrive in this kind of circumstance. In addition, water leads to the growth of molds. and these molds can exacerbate chronic lung diseases like asthma and emphysema and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
So what do you do to make that terrain habitable again?
Well,
that's, or you just wait 100 years?
That's more of an engineering question than I was listening to the first part of this program with great interest. I'm not an expert on how you right. deal with this kind of catastrophic flooding.
Uh-huh. Can I ask a health more explicitly? We have this response of wanting to do something, to send stuff to New Orleans, whether it's medical supplies, food, water, etc. From a health perspective, given the scenario you've painted, should we be focusing perhaps more on getting the people out? That is an exodus of people distributed throughout the region or the country, etc., because bringing other stuff in is going to not necessarily solve this immediate problem.
Well, it has been announced today. The governor, in fact, has said they want everybody out of New Orleans completely.
Right.
We haven't heard any strong promises about when they would be allowed to return. But are you suggesting that we should put off their return for a long, long time?
Well, at least until these kinds of issues are resolved, absolutely.
Yeah. What do you think about that, Dr. Hirschau?
Well, I would agree that at least in the short term, evacuation will be health insuring and life saving to a large extent in this scenario. A lot of the kind of advice we give after these kinds of catastrophes, such as severe hurricanes, have no applicability. You know, the idea of advising someone to limit the amount of standing water around their domicile has little merit in a situation where the entire city is flooded and where the domicile doesn't exist anymore. I think there's just a very strong case can be made right now for exactly what the governor is asking for, if indeed he has asked for complete evacuation of New Orleans.
You know, there's another health dimension here that interests me by virtue of my profession being psychology. Perhaps it's a lesser matter, but still, what do you do about the trauma and the disorientation that probably hundreds of thousands of people are feeling right now down there?
Again, I'm an infectious disease doctor, and I'm not fully capable of speaking to that. It is, of course, true that one of the kinds of morbidity that we see after these kinds of disasters is psychiatric exacerbation of existing illnesses and psychiatric problems. I don't have any glib answers. I think, generically speaking, we want people to tap into as much of their existing social network as they can. If that means evacuating to friends and family and other locations, that may be the best choice for many people.
But as Al Hunter has pointed out, social networks are dispersed by virtue of the catastrophe.
Well, this is where I think we have to, I think that's a wonderful point made about the social networks, and there are different ways of tapping into them, though, which is to not think of moving individuals, but moving families,
whole
groups, moving neighborhoods, where you can maintain that. And then the other is, of course, that people have metropolitan-wide and national family networks that they can go to as well. So the question is how to provide resources for people to tap into those pre-existing networks, which would reduce this disorientation and this isolation that is a consequence.
Meanwhile, there probably is now an immediate medical emergency, just in terms of treating people who are potentially infected or actually infected or otherwise traumatized to the point of physical stress which might kill them. Will the medical facilities that used to be available but no longer are in New Orleans, will they be properly replaced by new people and by new materials coming into town?
I mean, I think we'll have to see, again, how it evolves. There would be no point in rushing medical facilities into an area that's being evacuated.
You'd have to do it on the periphery rather than...
But on the periphery, yes, I think... probably the most important thing that could be done to help would be to accelerate the restoration of medical care services. and improving access to prescription medications that people have lost access to as a result of this catastrophe. I think other basic things that could help are anything that would improve sanitation in these areas, everything from garbage collection to storm debris pickup, is a very high priority right now. I think safe water is another, you know, if I were to put together a wish list, I think improving the public's awareness about water safety, about how to treat water if you don't have access to a reliable, safe water supply is a key thing that has to go on. And, you know, and I think other basic public health functions need to be in full swing, including information dissemination, education of the public about issues like how to treat water, how to deal with everything from wounds to water safety, et cetera. And I think, as a point that was made earlier, that we need to learn from this episode. So there has to be good surveillance so that we can measure the magnitude of what's happened here, so that we can keep track for the future, if nothing else, that we can keep track of precisely what kinds of health problems emerge in these kinds of situations. Really an unprecedented situation, I think, for the United States. And the other value of surveillance, of course, is that we can do rapid forms of surveillance to rapidly assess the needs of various pockets and communities that develop around the periphery of these kinds of disasters to see precisely what kinds of interventions are needed.
Well, Dr. Hershow, thank you very much. You've contributed a great deal to our conversation, though it doesn't ease my mind about the terrible crisis that they're facing down there, and that will, in a way, have repercussions for all the country for some time to come. But you've made an excellent contribution. I thank you for joining us on short notice.
Thank you for inviting me.
And with that, we will pause and take care of a quick round of messages. Then back to Charles Dowding and Albert Hunter in the studio, and yet another guest expected in just a little while. But first, these words. And discussing the crisis and disorder that have followed upon the devastation wrought by Hurricane Katrina. We are continuing in conversation with Albert Hunter and Charles Dowding. Albert Hunter is professor of sociology at Northwestern University, and at the same university, Charles Dowding is professor of civil and environmental engineering. You know, we've talked about New Orleans. We've said a word about Mobile, or closer to New Orleans still, Gulfport and Biloxi, and very heavy devastation was wrought there. I've watched some of the coverage today. Everything along the shore has been destroyed. Whole buildings, large gambling casinos have been picked up and hurled half a mile away. Incredible force did that. Should all of that be rebuilt? Or is there a question as to whether life along the Gulf Coast essentially is a bad idea?
Well, I think the question is if the federal government is to subsidize the reconstruction, is what is the wisest and best use of this federal money for that reconstruction? I think we're beginning to rethink some of the federal programs that merely make people whole in the same place that they were destroyed.
What federal programs do you have in mind?
Well, for instance, there's a floodplain insurance program where the federal government subsidizes the floodplain insurance for those people below the poverty line. And basically that means the federal government is subsidizing these people to move back into the floodplain zone from which they were displaced by the flood. Well, when you think about this, this doesn't really make a lot of sense for a long-term federal policy because there'll be another flood.
Right.
But even returning to New Orleans, as we were, in fact, discussing privately during the last batch of commercials, can we give up the culture of New Orleans? It's had a very distinctive role in American life. For one obvious thing, it's the source of jazz.
Chicago might question the source.
Well, the Chicago School came later. We've all been to New Orleans. We've all loved, as academics, to go to our conventions when they're held in New Orleans rather than elsewhere.
Right, right. And I think you're absolutely right. This is where each
take it
city,
away from America, and you're sort of changing America for the worse, are you not?
Well, this is where when we think about a city or we think about a community, I think there are a couple of separate dimensions we want to have in mind. And this is where two of them become joined. That is, one is an ecological, physical entity. I mean, Chicago would not be Chicago if it were not located on the Great Lakes, where it is. So there is a physical reality to New Orleans. But secondly, there is the cultural symbolic meaning, and how is that joined to the physical reality? And the question becomes now, what is the cultural symbolic meaning of New Orleans here? Can you still have a New Orleans if it's located elsewhere?
If Paris, if Paris suffered a devastating earthquake, and some practical engineer said, it's not worth rebuilding this place.
Right, right.
You'd still have to rebuild it, wouldn't you?
That's the point. You would have to bring the symbolism and the geography back together. And that's the question with New Orleans here. And so,
And I think you have the economic investment and the economic web that weaves through both the culture and the geographical significance of these cities.
But if you really try to rebuild it and restore New Orleans to what it was before Katrina came ashore, how long would it take? And what would it take?
Well, I think it's a multi-year, perhaps decades-long process that will be required to do this. I'm just even thinking of where are we going to put all of the detritus that will have to be collected. I mean, where does it go? I mean, what if a significant percentage of all the wood frame homes have to be dismantled and rebuilt? I mean, that just where does all that go?
Chicago built Grand Park.
Use it as landfill.
Exactly.
Build some new barrier islands to protect the city from hurricanes.
Right. But this is where I'm thinking that we have to reconceptualize cities and take advantage of the fact that we are living in the 21st century and figure out how we might reconfigure geographically. Well, and
now, gentlemen, I'm going to another guest who's with us by phone. This is Brandon Walker, who's on the production staff at WGNO. If that sounds familiar, it is in fact a Tribune-owned television station in New Orleans. But you are, sir, now, and all of your colleagues up in Baton Rouge, is that right?
Yes, sir.
When did your bunch move up there, and why?
Well, the plan came to send us to Baton Rouge after our meteorologist basically said that the storm is en route to our area. So our general manager and our chief engineer and our news director came up with the idea of sending us up here to Baton Rouge to our sister station, WBRZ. So with that, we came up here Sunday, we set up staff, and we basically combined with the WBRZ News 2 staff to come as one staff to the public, which in turn has proved to be very good to our viewers because people have been seeing hand-on accounts of what's going on in the city of New Orleans from New Orleanians out there who they're used to seeing covering the news.
Now, what is going on in New Orleans? We've been pontificating about it, but we're far away, and we don't know your town. But we've all been there, of course. But how bad is it in terms of the social disorganization as well as in terms of the physical problems?
Well, you've got people around basically trying to find somewhere to go. The National Guard is in the process of trying to rescue people from all over the metro area. People have been totally displaced by the storm and have nowhere to go. As a result, they've set up shelters all over the place in the state. Some people going to Lafayette, some people coming here to Baton Rouge, some people going to LSU, some are going out of state even to Texas at the Astrodome. So socially, this has proved to be a life-changing event for many people around here. It also has become somewhat grim for others. For example, Mayor Nagin has, there's been some looting going on in the area. Mayor Nagin has pulled 1,500 cops that are on the street, New Orleans police officers, to focus more on the looters going on. Now, you may see the pictures that say, you know, looting is big time in the area, but basically, these pictures you see are the pictures taken at one specific time, and they're, you know, being replayed over and over again. Yes, there's looting going on in the area. However, we do not know as of now to what extent. We do know that there's some, and the mayor and city officials are beginning to focus on that right now to end it.
There are also reports of armed gangs who armed themselves by breaking into gun shops and are now raging around the town. Is that true?
We have heard some accounts about that, but however, we cannot confirm it.
We've been discussing the question of how do you put New Orleans together again. I almost said Los Angeles. Maybe that was a wish. How do you put the town together again after all of this?
Well, it's going to have to take time, and it's something that people do not want to hear right now, but it's going to have to take time. You know, you have to look at the facts. New Orleans basically is a big soup bowl, and we've heard it over and over and over again. Well, this time, it's become a reality. New Orleans is a soup bowl, and it's going to have to take time to pump the water out. It's going to take time to assess the land. It's going to have to take time for people to get in and see what the deal is at their personal homes and for them to rebuild and get jobs and get the school systems back up. So it's going to have to take time. Time is what's going to rebuild New Orleans.
But you think there is a resolve to put it all together again?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering, could I ask a question?
Sure.
If one were to put New Orleans together again, what would New Orleans suggest are the most significant and important elements of New Orleans that have to be reproduced?
Well, I think the spirit. When we all think of New Orleans, we think of a happy-go-lucky town, you know, people used to having fun. Well, that's not the case right now. Speaking to several New Orleanians in this area, in Baton Rouge right now, who have evacuated, the spirit's gone. And we just really have to realize, you know, a lot of people are worrying about the materialistic things. You know, it's just sometimes you just have to worry. The materialistic things do not make you who you are. As long as you've got your life, you're fine. You know, just the spirit of New Orleans. If New Orleanians regain that spirit that has made them, that has made us rather, who we are, we'll be up and running again in no time.
Would this be things like Mardi Gras that you're thinking of specifically, or,
well, not
or
necessarily,
more than that?
Not necessarily Mardi Gras, more than that. New Orleans is much more than Mardi Gras. But
no, I'm speaking as an outsider, obviously. Right?
Yeah, well, not necessarily Mardi Gras, but just gratitude, having a good time, you know, happy-go-lucky, a little lackadaisical at times.
How's the what's the reaction of your own staff? All of the broadcasters and the engineers and so on, are they a little flattened by this, or are they excited because of the big story they've got to cover?
Oh, no, not at all. They're flattened because basically many of us here from New Orleans, from the WGNO staff who came up here, a lot of us are homeless. And
your own homes may well have been destroyed, haven't they?
Well, some reporters who went out into the field had the opportunity to see their homes or the plot for which their home once stood on.
Oh, my.
So, and the problem is here in the media, here in the news, you know, people seem to forget that we're people, too, and we have lives. And we have to put our lives on the side every day to give you the story. Well, this time we are the story, but we can't let you know that.
Yeah, it's fast.
What percentage of your staff is still in New Orleans in the field reporting?
Well, we actually have no reporter stationed in New Orleans because of the area itself at this time. All of our reporters are here stationed in New Orleans. However, every day we send crews out to the New Orleans area to shoot, and they come back, put their stories together. Some go live. We did have a live shot from the New Orleans area today, but after that, our reporter packed up and came back here to Baton Rouge.
Is there some procedure that's employed in order to gain access to the city at this point? Is there some choke point?
Well, only emergency personnel are allowed back into the city, and Governor Kathleen Blanco said that the media is considered emergency personnel at this time. Mm-hmm. So the media does have the right to get into some areas. Now, areas that were hit hard, that are somewhat grim, that, you know, you really don't want to see, that we've heard are grim because we don't know, we haven't seen it, they're not really letting us get into cover.
The reason why I was asking that, I'm particularly interested in the levees and the pumping stations, and I was wondering if you've been able to send crews out to these breaches in the levees and the pumping stations to check on their physical disposition.
Well, no video itself of the breaks in the levees, but the reason why New Orleans is underwater is because of the breaches in the 17th Street Canal. Initially, after the storm had passed, the city really wasn't under much water. Yes, there was water in several places, but downtown New Orleans really didn't have much water in it. However, until the breach, when the breach in the 17th Street Canal came along, roughly yesterday, that's when yesterday and Monday as well, today's Tuesday. We've got my bearings.
Today's Wednesday. Things are moving pretty fast.
Moving so fast that, you know, we just don't know what day we're in at times because we're working around the clock right now. I mean, basically we're getting 2 hours of sleep every night, and that's been the case since Saturday.
Oh,
but with that, you know, it's basically the 17th Street Canal, which pumps the water out of the city of New Orleans into the lake. Well, what's happening is, since there's the breach in the canal, the water's overflowing into the city and is moving back into the city. Well, we're hearing that the water is receding at this time. We don't know, though. This hasn't been confirmed. And that, you know, slowly it's beginning to come back, and you're beginning to see more pictures of the houses and the damage itself so that they can be assessed.
Well, Brandon, thank you very much for joining us. I know you've got a very, very heavy schedule, and we do hope you get more than 2 hours of sleep tonight.
Okay, yes. Thank you. One more thing I want to say. I want to say before you let me go. The school system here in the city of New Orleans, well, according to the school system, obviously you've got people won't be able to get back to their homes into the city. They won't be able to get, you know, nestled in for a few months. Well, Superintendent Cecil Picard says we've got many students outside of schools right now, and they don't know, you know, they've got to put them somewhere. Well, East Baton Rouge Parish School Superintendent Charlotte Placide said today that she is going to allow those students displaced from hurricanes to be assumed into her school system here in East Baton Rouge Parish. And most likely that's going to be the case in other areas around. A lot of students.
Well, even in Texas, the governor of Texas announced that all the kids from New Orleans who wind up in Houston or elsewhere ought to be admitted into Texan schools.
Yeah, so that's the case right now. So basically, people are coming together to help everyone out, because basically we've got to look at it this way. Who knows when we're going to be allowed to get back into New Orleans and begin to rebuild.
Well, again, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
It's been a great revelation. One really does get the sense from talking to Brandon that the very questions that Al Hunter was talking about earlier are the crucial ones. Can you reconstitute community?
Right. And this is where I think I recognize the disaster, but I would almost like to somehow hold on to a silver lining somewhere here about the potential for rebuilding New Orleans. And I keep pushing this notion of how one would rebuild it, what it would look like, so that we don't simply retreat to an 18th or 19th or 20th century city, but we view some kind of potential here for rebuilding it in a new and a different way. And I don't have the utopian vision to be able to put it together tonight, but I would hope that this would be the direction that people would begin to be thinking.
Well, it does seem to me that we're really looking at something quite new in American history.
I think we are. I think we have a chance to redesign a city to be sustainable.
Yeah.
But I think that what comes along with sustainability in this case is designing the city to withstand another Category 3 or 4 hurricane. You know, so that's the real issue is not just building the city again, but can we build the city so it can sustain another hurricane
of
this nature?
Well, viewed physically, viewed in terms of engineering, what would that require if it were possible? We talked earlier about raising the level of the city. But that you said that wasn't really feasible.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think somehow maybe making it smaller pods as was suggested by Al is a possibility. That's an intriguing possibility. Perhaps designing structures to be flooded.
Float.
Well, we saw the floating casinos didn't do very well.
That's
so
true.
So I think things that float move too much in 130, 40-mile-an-hour winds, so that's probably not a great idea.
Is Venice a model in any way? What did the Venetians know?
Well, except our earlier guest, Professor Michael suggesting Venice would be good, except they don't have hurricanes. I think that would be the issue there. I don't know. But this is where I'm trying to suggest we have some kind of utopian notions here and rethink this, because obviously this is going to require enormous resources. And we might, and all I'm suggesting is rather than just simply reproducing the past, that it gives us the opportunity to think about
Well, some of our listeners may have some useful ideas along these lines, and of course many of them will have questions. We are now opening our phone lines. 591-7200 is the number, as usual. 591-7200. The lines are available to you. Get your calls in quickly. We hope to get to you right after some impending commercials. Also, of course, equally available to all and any, and especially those who are listening to us on the Internet elsewhere in the country and elsewhere in the world, the email address is extension720 at tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word, at Tribune, T-R-I-B-U-N-E.com, or 591-7200. Write onto your contributions after we pause for these words. And directly back to Charles Dowding, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Northwestern University, Albert Hunter, Professor of Sociology at Northwestern. And on to the phones and the email, 591-7200, and for email, extension 720 at tribune.com. And let me start, as I usually don't, with an email question, because this one goes directly to Charles Dowding, I'm sure. Very simple. A listener in Atlanta, Georgia, asks, one fundamental question about rebuilding New Orleans. Who will pay for it?
Well, I think we all need to contribute to this. I think that, they are all our fellow countrymen, and this is a time of national disaster. I think that we must shoulder the burden to help.
We through individual contributions or through our government, through our federal government.
I think all available channels should be used, and we should contribute as we are able. I hope that we have learned from the World Trade Center disaster how to better distribute privately raised monies, and hopefully those can be combined creatively with federal disaster relief funds.
I think this is a case where the sheer scale and magnitude of it, to try and rely on the private sector, the philanthropic sector, the voluntary sector, whatever one calls it, it's beyond the scale of that. This is the point where you need a strong central federal government to step in and say, here's where the resources are, the buck stops here, here's where we begin to redistribute the bucks.
I agree.
With that, gentlemen, on to the phones, 591-7200. If you're trying to reach us, of course, you're not getting through at the moment, but do continue to try, especially after we say goodnight to a prior caller. And here is the first. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening, professors. Another unique thing about this problem is this thing could happen again within a month. It's within the realm of possibilities. So I think we really need to do some smart thinking, and this emotional call for, oh, we're going to rebuild and bring it back, I think is a little very unrealistic. And my question is, does the political will exist? I think the most prudent course for the government is to use financial incentives for this refugee population to basically disperse to the metropolitan areas, wherever they want to move to. Because realistically, it's going to be, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years before these people can move back? And also a quarter of the population of that city lives below the poverty line. What sense does it make to move people that are on the government dole back into a hazardous situation? It makes no sense whatsoever, and I'd just like to hear comments on that.
I absolutely agree with you that it is, as I just stated a moment ago, it's going to require an enormous political will, and it's going to require the scale of the federal government to do it. I don't think any local communities, I don't even think the state of New Orleans is going to be able to shoulder the burden on this. It's going to require tax monies, and it's going to require that kind of commitment. And furthermore, I think it points to the need for a federal policy about these kinds of issues, rather than viewing this as a one-off notion that this is unique, et cetera. To be sure, it's unique now, but a variety of things like this should be anticipated. Federal policy should be in place to deal with it.
Yes, I don't believe it is correct to subsidize people to rebuild in potential hazardous locations, and that needs to be taken into account, and our policy has to be such that we build sustainable societies in locations where they are sustainable at a reasonable cost.
Our thanks to the caller. Let's go directly to another. 591-7200, the number, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. It's kind of a sociological and a technical question. A concern is that with, again, so many low-income people, as the previous caller said, I can see people leaving New Orleans with marketable skills getting jobs, but do we end up with refugee camps of people who don't have marketable skills and don't have a place to go, a second kind of technical question. If we look at rebuilding, do we let the river take its course and build a new seaport, but maybe try to preserve, if there's anything left of older New Orleans, as a recreational tourist kind of town?
Al Hunter.
Yes, on the first point, I think you've raised a fascinating point here about the dispersal of poverty. And we have had over the decades, if not a century, a concentration of poverty. And now with this, we are getting a decentralization of poverty. And this is something which we have not planned for. And so I think we need federal programs that focus, again, on jobs, on job training, and a variety of things for this population. And the question becomes how to integrate them into new and existing communities. We've already heard about children being integrated into the schools, but we've now got an adult population that have to be integrated into additional institutions, a central one being employment. And there are jobs out there. So we should be thinking not simply of getting them out of New Orleans, but also the direction that they go and what networks, what job potentials might exist out there. And that's got to be part of the planning process. I would absolutely agree with you.
And we thank you, sir,
for
the call and for the comment and to another on 591-7200. Good evening. You're on the air. Are you there?
Yes, sir.
Please.
Milt.
Yes, go ahead.
Milt, first of all, I'd like to say that you are the most greatest host of all time.
My mother thanks you, my father thanks you, and I thank you. Now go ahead.
But secondly, my question is, when the hurricane was first diagnosed coming into the Gulf, that they said they were going to take a direct hit on New Orleans. And evidently, it went up the coast to Biloxi, which was devastated, and also went to other ports
of to Gulfport and even to Mobile, Alabama. Yes,
exactly. My question for the panel and for you, Milt, is what really would have happened in this discussion if this hurricane would have hit New Orleans directly?
Yeah. Well,
we took a deflected hit.
Let's turn that question to Charles Doughty.
Well, it's hard to imagine that New Orleans could have been more devastated than it was by this. Of course, the greatest extensive damage has been rendered because of the failure of the levees. However, if you look at the conditions of many of the tall buildings, while the buildings themselves are still structurally sound, they've lost high percentages of their cladding. Many of the windows have been broken, so therefore there's rain has penetrated the superstructures. I guess we would have had a higher percentage of that type of damage. There would probably have been more failure of the lesser engineered structures than had occurred, and probably would have had a higher percentage failure of the levees, which is probably would have caused more rapid and more devastating flooding.
We are about to pause for the usual reasons and then directly back to the phones and to the email. Some phone lines are now available if you've been trying to reach us. Do make another quick try on 591-7200. And the capacity of the email is virtually infinite, though that is a mutual or self-contradictory phrase. But the email address, extension 720 at tribune.com. And we return to Professors Doughty and Hunter, both of Northwestern University. And gentlemen, here, this is an interesting email from Nashville. This may sound far-fetched, but at what point does the risk of rebuilding hurricane-prone locations such as Biloxi and New Orleans become prohibitive? Suppose another five hurricanes happen this year or next. There are many risks, the risk of life lost, property lost, and the emotional impact of loss, the great sadness that can kill the human soul's drive to go on. Well, this theme is a recurring theme tonight. Should we really be rebuilding New Orleans?
Yeah, right. Well, it's impossible to create a risk-free world. I mean, let's put that right out. So the, it becomes a kind of cost-benefit analysis, and I don't just mean in monetary terms, but a psychic cost-benefit analysis.
Let me interrupt you. Just read another quick email,
sure.
And then I want you to continue. Same theme, played another way. If global warming is truly happening, why rebuild a city below sea level when evidently the dikes it currently has are not sufficient?
Yeah.
I don't think it really relates to global warming. We've said that.
Right.
But why rebuild a city below sea level?
Right. Well, again, it's... I don't think you do build a city below sea level. We've learned that. This is a lesson we've learned. It's how do you build the city and what form does it take? What's the morphology of it physically on the land, and what do you do to the land? And I think we do have to account these costs of doing that. You know, I hate to say it, but one of the potential ways of viewing this is instant urban renewal. And that we had the Chicago fire, yep. You know, that destroyed a large portion of Chicago. Chicago rebuilt after the Chicago fire in the 1870s, and at that point was more efficient and outdistanced St. Louis and became the city of the Midwest. New Orleans has the potential here to rebuild, but you don't rebuild it the way it was. That's the point I keep trying to come back to here. So we rebuild, but rebuild differently, and what that different is, that's where good minds have to come together.
And you rebuild it elsewhere is really what you're
conceivably
saying.
Conceivably, with different, again, I'm not an engineer, yep. But with different, you know, engineering capacities, but you still define something as New Orleans, right?
Right. You know, we did mention earlier whether or not the Mississippi should be allowed to flow down the Atchafalaya
right.
River.
Right.
You know, I mean, that might be something that should be probably not taken off the table here as this is noodled about in the, you know, in the think tanks in Washington, D.C. who are going to have to wrestle with this problem.
Well, that's what happens
deeply.
That's what happens in the think tanks.
Yeah.
But you know a great deal, you both of you surely do, about what happens in government. Yeah. Is government free to be this inventive when it comes to the restoration of New Orleans?
Ooh.
I think it is in this sense. That people will want to keep something called New Orleans. What that is and how it's built it can be quite different. If the river flows elsewhere, for example, people, the economic and power elite of New Orleans can say, okay, we will no longer necessarily have a port city here like Athens with respect to its port, Greece.
Piraeus.
Yeah. You know, it could be separated. The port will mm-hmm. be over here, New Orleans will be here, and we will redefine it, reconfigure it in this fashion, creative. I think there are economic and political interests to do that. In the case of Galveston, Texas, where it's mm-hmm. at its disaster, they were very innovative in coming up with a whole new form of government, which is now with us, the commission form of government.
Do remind our listeners,
yes.
particularly the younger ones, what the Galveston disaster was.
Well, it was, a major hurricane that wiped out a large portion of the city.
The year was?
Early 1900s. I don't have the exact. Do you know that, Chuck?
Somewhere here in my papers I had that.
Early 1900s.
Yeah.
In rebuilding Galveston, they came up with an idea of setting up separate commissions to deal with police and fire and safety, to deal with education, to deal with health. And it worked so well, they said, well, let's create these commissions on a permanent basis. And you then had the birth of the commissioner form of mm-hmm. government. So where there's a political will to rebuild and an economic interest in rebuilding, I think they will rebuild. And they may come up with new arrangements in terms of governmental structure, political structures. They may come up with a new morphology, physical structure for the nature of it. But I think there will be something called New Orleans. It will not disappear symbolically from the map.
What has begun to happen, and have they faced any similar questions in the wake of the great tsunami of last year in any of the related countries? Have they faced similar questions? Was there a major city that was as heavily injured as New Orleans has been? I think not.
No. I don't think it's the largest city, no.
No.
No, I think it was much more, it was obviously much more extensive in terms of its coastal impact. That is, the amount of coastline yeah. that was damaged, but I don't think.
Well, we didn't learn much there then.
Yeah, yeah.
We go back to the phones, 591-7200. Good evening.
this is great fun. It's sort of like
it's not supposed to be
to a group of people sort of quasi-brainstorming.
Yeah, but it's not supposed to be fun. This is too dreadful a topic.
Oh, I know. It's a dreadful situation, but it's like, what creative ideas can you come up with? And it's kind of fun listening to what's going on. Actually, I'm more concerned about the refugees. You know, they're going to be like 1 million, and they can't go back for a couple of months, and it's going to be really nasty. And I was wondering, somebody came up with the idea, and I thought it was pretty clever. They said, well, what about building housing, like a little city next to agricultural centers where we grow food, and having these people harvest food and live in a really great place, you know, really good medical care, like a little city. Okay, and then when it's time to go back, they decide to go back. They go back to whatever new place is set up, or while they're there in this new arrangement, if they want training for another skill, if they're unskilled, they can be trained in that situation. And the money for this would come from the illegal aliens who now pick food would be asked to return to their own country. And the money that we now spend for health care and education and all that would then go for these little cities. And when they leave, people that need retraining and things like that could then be, you know, in this situation. What do you think?
I think we ought to get back to the drawing board.
Sort of like the WPA or something.
Oh, yeah.
Like that.
No, no. I think WPA would work here. I don't think we should be hunting for a single silver bullet here as a solution to, quote-unquote, the refugee problem. First of all, I think we should come up with a better name. Terribly important how we label things. And I think labeling the New Orleans residents as refugees, we might want to better rethink a label here. So that would be my first
thing. They're very much victims,
yeah, I think. Yeah. And secondly, the absence of a silver bullet, I would suggest we think of a shotgun approach if we wanted to stick with bullets or something. I don't mean to be jocular on this, but that there are a variety of different things. One of them we just sat around talking about a moment ago is with all the recent base closings that are occurring in terms of the military, that we might want to keep some of these bases and use them as seeds, if you will, pods to start new communities or to at least house people maybe on a midterm basis, that is, for a year or so. So there's a variety of different options I think we should be exploring here and not a singular option. I'm not even going to get into the issue of illegal migrants at this point. I think we have enough to deal with on this.
I think we do for tonight. And right now we have to deal with a quick round of commercials, the last round, and then back to the phones. I see one line available at the moment, 591-7200. And, of course, you can easily get through via email, and we'll read a few more emails, that being extension 720 at tribune.com. 591-7200, our number as we go back to the phones, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes.
I am a New Orleanian, and I just happen to be passing through and listening, trying to get pieces of information. And I have to respond because I found myself offended by the last couple of callers.
Mm-hmm.
The gentleman saying that we should just all be dispersed into different places, and then the woman saying that we should farm your vegetables. You're talking about, you know, professors from some of the best universities in the country. They're going to farm vegetables. They're going to be re-educated to become manual laborers. And I understand that those aren't your opinions. Those are the callers. But I want to let people know out there that, you know, the news, they're always going to focus on the worst. And it is a terrible, terrible, you know, it's a disastrous situation. But I'm not hearing about my neighborhood. And when I go on blogs, the reason I'm finding I'm not hearing about my neighborhood is it's that I'm not in really bad shape. I mean, my house is still there. There are huge sections of the town that received 1 or 2 inches of flooding. They received some wind damage, but they're you know, close to being habitable.
Are you in touch with your family down there?
No. You know, we all except for one brother-in-law that we haven't been able to find. All of us made it out, and we were staying in Arkansas, and now I have family in Wisconsin, so we're on our way to stay with them.
Where are you calling from at the moment?
Where am I calling you from?
Yeah.
In my car.
where are you located?
Actually, I'm in Mequon, Wisconsin.
All right.
We're going to be staying in the Milwaukee area.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure we all agree with you that it's a great town, and there are wonderful people there, and very talented and important people.
Right.
It's interesting that you mentioned the professors first. I would have mentioned the jazz musicians, but one way or the other.
Right.
The town must be conserved, but the question is how you put it together,
right,
and whether you do it on the same location and try to somehow reproduce just what was there before.
And I think one of the point I made earlier at an earlier point in the program was trying to get at what are the different elements and essences of New Orleans, and precisely these are the elements that we want to think about preserving and rebuilding, and the ones you've mentioned, and the idea that certain neighborhoods definitely would be preserved. I mean, as an outsider, a visitor, et cetera, I cannot imagine New Orleans without the French Quarter. So somewhere that's going to be reproduced or created or whatever needs to be done.
Can we ask the caller where in New Orleans do you live?
Yeah.
I lived in Uptown New Orleans near Tulane University for years. But
okay.
3 years ago, I moved to an area called River Ridge, which is along the river levee further to the west. So it is in Jefferson Parish now.
Okay. Well, we are most pleased to have heard from you, ma'am, and good luck to you and all of your people.
All right. Thank you very much.
We'll
have a good night.
Go quickly to another caller on 591-7200. Good evening.
Hello, I'm a land use planner, and I'd like to suggest that as a reconstruction certainly will occur with perhaps some additional engineering thought, and the locational aspects may come into play as well, but there could be a real opportunity to reconstruct those neighborhoods in ways that the terms of smart growth, or maybe a better term is the new urbanism, where new neighborhoods can be constructed that are more sustainable from the standpoint of densifying it to build denser than some of the later neighborhoods that may have been built in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s, that can be more walkable, more access to commercial, and a number of other things that actually could put a certain population in a much smaller area to the benefit of the residents with more sustainable community, leaving much larger areas back into open space that could be restored. And that's just a principle that I wanted to throw into the mix of the conversation on the idea of sustainability.
Surely.
No, I absolutely agree, and I think this is precisely the kind of new morphology I would suggest that we have to play with here. And we simply do not rebuild it as it was.
And
we scratch that from the board. You know.
The good news is there's actually been a lot of progress in the thinking on land use planning and how
right.
we construct new communities than there was when many of what I'm seeing in the aerial footage of the flooded areas, there
right.
could be a real opportunity to turn that around.
If you want denser communities, does that mean you build vertically? You simply get more apartment buildings in there?
Well, that could be one of the aspects, but even when you think of how development was done in the 50s and 60s and 70s, which from the aerials that I've seen of the footage, there's a lot of that there. The lot sizes are actually much larger
mm-hmm.
than necessary, so
right.
it may not just be vertically, that could be part of the formula, but even building on smaller lots closer together, really more like the inner urban core, more like the French Quarter as an
right.
inspiration,
uh-huh.
but to build the new areas the same
right.
way.
And you might have pods of these, 100,000 each, et cetera, that would sustain a lot of institutions and be connected by all kinds of, you know, 21st century transport, et cetera.
Did you have any thoughts as to sustainability vis-a-vis hurricane force winds and possible flooding? I mean,
well, I think part of that is there's not a lot of high ground, obviously, but let's say that you could put that population back, or I'm going to assume it's going to be a little lesser population, that some people will end up somehow being dispersed or may end up staying where they're going to be settling soon. Let's say you go back with some percentage of the population that was there. You might be able to put that on less than half or closer to a third of the area that it took up now. Certainly, I would focus on every inch of higher ground in doing that.
Sir, let me ask you to stay with us while I read an email question, and I'd be interested in your response as well as the responses of my two guests in studio. Was there any planning on how to repair the breaches in the levees of New Orleans before the storm? Everyone knew that the levees were going to fail in a large hurricane, and that it was a matter of when, not if, such a storm would hit. I would think that the first step of such a repair would be to float pre-built structures to the break and fill them with water or rocks to establish solid anchor points. In any case, doesn't it make sense to build the structures of steel and concrete to repair a breach before the emergency? What do you think? I'll go to the caller first.
Well, I think now we're getting into some engineering issues, but my one comment would be in the term, the definition of sustainability, I think, means to not have to rely. Even the fact that, and it's not that New Orleans had a choice, it's been earlier mentioned that it was an evolution.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't intended that that size of a city were built in that location initially. But to rely on over-relying on levees and pumps and other mechanical and structural means is the beginning of the mistake, actually. So if there's a way to look to higher ground or to move a certain amount of population up away back off of the coast and further from the river, leaving some level of community where it is now, like building around the French Quarter or what it may be, makes sense. But
Charles Dowding, going back to this email, could they have done better on keeping the levees intact or improving them?
I agree with the caller that having some plan for repairing a breach in the levee makes a lot of sense. I just don't know myself whether or not they did have one. It appears that they may not have had sufficient plans for this. Right. But you know, the canal systems are such that it's going to be very hard to float these structures in place. They would have had to been in each canal themselves, I think.
Let me thank the caller and go to one more quick one. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening, Milt.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for taking my call. My question for your guests are basically in regards to the Dutch and what we could do and what we could really learn from their experiences in holding back the sea from a very large low-lying area. And, you know, how that could be applied to this situation.
Can we learn anything from the Dutch? Most of their coastal cities are, in fact, below sea level, are they?
They have the same situation topographically. However, they don't have the same situation relative to hurricanes.
Again, exactly. No hurricanes.
Yeah. It's the Venice. It's the Venice point again.
So there's nothing much to be learned from the Dutch.
Well, I suspect there may be, you know, information to be learned about building levees, but let me assure you that the Corps of Engineers spends a lot of time talking to people around the world, and they're not unmindful of the technical challenges that are faced in New Orleans.
Our thanks to that caller, and this is truly the last, again, email. Certainly the location and topography of New Orleans may be unique. However, three scholars from Chicago should not think that rebuilding a city from total devastation is unique. Can we learn from Chicago's experience of the 1870s, San Francisco's of the 1900s, or that of Rouen, Warsaw, Berlin, Hamburg, or Dresden?
The answer is yes. We can learn, and we should learn, and that it's not simply an...
Those are all cities that rebuilt.
Yes, exactly. But the point is, it's not simply a question of technology. It's also a question of political and organizational will, I think, here to do that.
I think also it's a question of meteorological consideration as well. And I think that, you know, to be sustainable, you must be mindful of the highly statistical probable occurrence of Category 3 and Category 4 hurricanes.
Of course, Patrick Michaels, when he spoke to us earlier tonight, suggested there's a way of seeding hurricanes to reduce their force.
Right, so maybe we need to think more about changing the weather, which we all dream about every night.
Right.
Well, Mark Twain said, we talk about it all the time, we don't know anything about it.
Right.
But really, is that feasible scientifically?
Gosh.
I have no idea.
I've heard about cloud seeding a lot, especially during times of drought, and I've not heard of statistically how well that does.
I have no idea, but I just know that we spend an awful lot of time not so much trying to control the weather, but how we respond to it as we sit in this air-conditioned studio.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. It's been an exceptionally valuable program, I think, and I'm much in your debt. My guests have been Charles Dowding, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Northwestern University, and Albert Hunter, Professor of Sociology at Northwestern University. Earlier, we were joined by Patrick Michaels from the University of Virginia, Dr. Ronald Hershow from the School of Public Health of the University of Illinois here in Chicago.